Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com.
Are you missing your eggs? $7 a dozen, right? You know, I go back and think, we wanted to kind of raise chickens. Well, my wife wanted that more than I did. And I thought, why would you raise chickens? Because you can go down to Costco and buy a fully raised and cooked chicken at $5. And then you don't have foxes in your yards. But there might be a reason, right? If you're missing your eggs at $7 a dozen on the average, up 20 to 25% across the country, what's behind that? It's the avian flu. Bird flu. We'll talk more about that today as Colton Young joins us here, egg specialist with the Northern Egg Network. A bit later on, we'll talk more about our economy. The U.S. economy continues to grow, but there's still challenges with inflation and market fluctuations. Mike Bondra will join us a bit later on today on Voices. Oh, Montana. We'll dig into the economy here in just a little bit. Of course, the tariffs, the threat, and trade. How does that affect our markets, which affects our daily lives? Mike Bondra will join us, certified financial planner. His father's father was doing this job, and he's done a good job with it as well. Will join us in just a little bit. We're going to talk about this avian bird flu because, you've been to the market, and you've seen the price of eggs go up. And then you've also, Cody had an experience as well. He wandered around going, I want to find a manager. How come I can only get a couple dozen eggs there? These things are affecting us. And now I'll talk a little bit, too, about how many wings that we're going to eat this Sunday on Super Bowl Sunday. In fact, I'll just get it out there. 1.45 billion chicken wings, not eggs, chicken wings. Pardon me. And that's enough, actually, to stretch one third of the way to the moon. So give me some chicken wings all the way to the moon is what we need. Colton Young joins us here, egg specialist with the Northern Ag Network. Grew up as part of the ranching and auction community. It's kind of a odd partnership, but that's sometimes tough in the way it is. But also with the Northern Ag Network, northernag.net, and was looking into this. Good morning, Colton.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I appreciate being on here.
Thanks for being here. There's some stories that we were, as we were kind of just chatting here before getting on the air, about chickens. And, you know, you raised some chickens as well. And you just the whole guard dog thing about the hen house, so to speak, is kind of fun. And I think a lot of people have those familiar stories, especially in rural Montana. That's why I think a lot of us don't get what's going on. With the avian bird flu and what the numbers are. We see the price of eggs go up. I see myself limited to four wings on Sunday. I'm not happy about that. Where do we start?
You know, it's been an ongoing issue, the avian flu. We talk about it, and I think this is the largest outbreak we've seen in U.S. history. And I think that's why everyone's really starting to see the effects from it. But we saw the largest one back in 2014, 2015. Didn't really affect us a ton here in Montana. You know, we're so rurally diverse and we have our own culture here that we don't tend to see a lot of these issues. But, you know, over the last 2 years, since 2022, we've lost 104 million egg-laying hens.
Put that in perspective for us. I mean, is that like 15% of the U.S. population market, or is that larger than that? Or
it definitely larger than that. You know, 104 million egg-laying hens, that's close to 30-40% of what we're looking at that has been killed since 2022. Now, granted, we kind of slowed down the avian flu in 23, and then it came back hard in April of 24. Since then, it's been the largest outbreak we've ever seen. And then in November and December, so the last 2 months, we've lost over 17 million egg-laying hens.
Wow. And it's hard to kind of fathom that. So what's the dynamic behind this avian flu? Where is there a cure for it? Is there a threat to the human population? What's the dynamic behind
it? You know, the avian flu, obviously, it's the mortality rate in poultry is upwards of 90%. And within 48 hours. So it gets in. Migratory birds are really what's spreading the avian flu. You know, we see a lot of these colonies, they have free-range chickens. They have free-range poultry animals. migratory birds in the fall heading down south and the spring coming back up, they're what's carrying this avian flu. And the fact that, you know, there's not a lot of biosecurity in those facilities, that's what's causing these large outbreaks. And there's several different ways that we can kind of conquer the avian flu. One is obviously, you know, first people think the flu, okay, you have a vaccine, right? Well, yes, the USDA does have several different vaccines that they have tested, tried and true, to work on the avian flu. But the problem is with the amount of U.S. exports that we trade, all of our trade contracts for poultry are all under contract. And those contracts specifically state that we are not allowed to use an avian flu vaccine on our poultry products. That's what's causing us not to use. The USDA has clearly stated they are not using the vaccines that they have stockpiled for the avian flu. And so the next best way that we've been conquering the avian flu for decades and decades is to kill the population. You know, you get it in your flock, you kill the flock, you manage it. You get rid of the avian flu by killing all of your flock.
And I had a question earlier, but you answered that. And, you know, when we get the flu, depending, I guess, on the nature of it, and there's lots of varieties of it, if we're in a pretty good shape, we'll you know, power through it, so to speak, and then we build up immunities. But when you said 90% fatality in the first 48 hours, so that is not a step that these birds can take. Do you? I know you don't know everything about it. What about our migratory birds? Why do they carry it and then not die off from it?
Well, yeah, and you know that's a really good point. You think about it, so it has that 90% fatality rate within 48 hours. Those migratory birds are dying from it as well. We are seeing those effects, but they're not killing the entire flock. So, you know, you get a few in each flock and that goes on. But then when they come back, seasonal movement, they're going to the same locations, mm-hmm. using the same shared places that all of those other birds have used, which is test positive for that avian flu. So they're coming back, flying right back into it. And then they spread it across the colonies, flying here, flying there. And that's where we continue to see all of the outbreaks, is because it dies away for a while. They stay down south. When they come right back up, they're going to the same locations they were back then.
And then it lives. It lives in the saliva or the feces or things that are left over in that regard. You talked about how we combat that. And I want to get into that a little more. We'll talk about maybe the human aspect of it here in a little bit. And I understand that it has spread to the bovine, some bovine populations too, which is interesting. But so combating this, what other measures do we need to take?
You know, personally, and I think kind of just talking with some of the other people in the ag department here, I think biosecurity is probably our biggest concern. You know, you go to the store and you see on your carton of eggs, it says free range chickens, free range egg laying hens.
Or free cage.
Or free cage, cage free. Yeah, exactly. Cage free, you know, yeah. And that's what the consumer wants to see, you know. But in the aspect, like in the reality of it, when those migratory birds are coming through cage-free, all of those other egg-laying hens are out in the open. The migratory birds come in. They share the same feed. They share the same water troughs. That's where they get the flu. So if we're more secure, if we keep them in containment, keep them in those cages, we can control the spread of the virus a lot easier.
So the moves that our policymakers make regarding this, they seem to be reactive and not proactive in this regard. Now we're going to react to this, and I don't know if the damage has been done, so to speak, and that's kind of hard to assess. But is there any, as you talk with ag experts, are they thinking now more proactively regarding this?
You know, I think they are, and I'm going to point out that the confirmation hearing of Brooke Rollins, the Secretary of Ag, one of her first priorities is going to be to create more biosecurity laws, regulations to control the spread of avian flu. That's one of her top priorities. You know, we've also been seeing a lot of other diseases recently in the ag industry with the New World screwworm virus in cattle, Mexican cattle. So the border closed down for a couple of months. We did see that just open up here this week because they got control spread of the virus. And I think that's something we're going to see with this new administration, Brooke Rollins coming in when you know, when confirmed that that's on top of her priority and that they're going to try to get that handled as soon as possible.
And it is an international concern because some of these strains emerged in China and then made their way across the globe, so to speak. So it's not just something that this country needs to deal with.
No, absolutely not. It's a world outbreak. You know, we're just seeing the effects of the largest one in the United States currently, which is why all of the talk and discussion has been on that. But then, you know, like I said earlier, the USDA says they have a vaccine for it. And it's just the fact that our trade contracts say we're not allowed to give vaccinations to all of our exports. And so I think that's where we can kind of tie in globally and finding those common ways. How do we stop this spread so that the better of the good can occur, you know?
Colton Young is with us, ag specialist with the Northern Ag Network. Did a study on this and reported as well, and this was a little while ago, northernag.net for more information there. Mike Vondrit's going to join us here in just a little bit. We'll talk about the U.S. economy and some of the challenges as well as the opportunities as a certified financial planner. Humans, can we get this flu?
We can. Yep, we've seen 69 cases currently of the avian flu in humans. Luckily, the fatality rate is very, very low. I mean, it's just like getting a normal flu that we see, influenza A or whatever, you know, around here. It's going to be a couple days, little rough for you, but then after that, we should, you know, build up that immunity just fine.
That's good. Next to humans come cows.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that this flu... I shouldn't be overly surprised because it's a, you know, it's a bacteria.
It is. It's a bacteria that's easily spreading. You know, we're seeing it right now. There's been over 950 dairy herds that have reported a live virus. And you think about dairy cattle, for example, right? Everywhere they go, they are sharing the same milking parlors, the same feed troughs, the same water trough, the same pen. So, I mean, one migratory bird gets in their pen, spreads it to a cow, they share that bacteria, and bam, it's spread everywhere, you know? And luckily, the fatality rate for cattle is less than 2%. So, I mean, they're similar to humans. You know, they're going to get it for a while. You're going to see, for all of those EID, those electronic tags, you can track their health. You're going to see the effects of it for a couple of days, but then it'll wear off eventually.
Is it something regulators need to address in the bovine population?
You know, I wouldn't be too concerned about it. There's a lot of health regulations, and obviously, you know, when you go and buy your beef, you're going to cook your meat thoroughly. The reason for that is to kill all the bacteria in your meat. So, I mean, as long as you are taking careful actions and making sure your meat is cooked thoroughly, there really should be no harm to you whatsoever.
Same thing they recommend for your eggs as well.
Absolutely. Yep, okay. Yep. They recommend the same thing. I mean, that's the whole point of all of those health regulations, cooking your food thoroughly, is to kill the bacteria that naturally occurs.
There's a fear of mutation, and scientists have warned, you know, it comes with any influenza, so to speak. And there's been a little bit of that discovered in this one.
There has. They've discovered a new mutation. They're calling it the 87N9. And so they found it a little bit in turkeys. I don't have a whole lot of information that has come out currently on that. It's a new strain. It's still young. Currently, I think, you know, just this 85N1 strain is at the top of everyone's minds right now. We're trying to figure out how we can control that. And until we can, we're going to start to see a couple different strains occur. And honestly, I think the solution is going to be the same for all of them. You know, we really need to harp down on our biosecurity, close those doors, make sure that we're not spreading it any more than we absolutely have to. And then, you know, the USDA just got to figure out what they want to do with the vaccine.
And eggs and chicken wings are a big part of your diet, aren't they, Colton?
They are a huge part. I eat way too many, probably more than I should, but it's a good source of protein. And yeah, I don't think I can cut back for a little while.
So you dug into this topic because it affects you in the midsection then, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Right, it sure does. My CrossFit classes get a little tiring when I can't have my eggs in the morning. You know?
Thank you for this. I mean, are we at the midway point of this? I know that's hard to gauge, so to speak, and it's not biblically written, so to speak, but where are we at with this?
You know, like I said, we've seen over 17 million egg-laying hens killed in November and December. Yeah. That's a huge number, and currently we are seeing the prices and the reflections of that in our grocery stores. I would like to say that we're somewhere in the halfway point. We're definitely going to see more deaths. Those prices are going to continue to grow. I want to say, though, like, there's been a lot of stipulation about the inflation is causing a lot of this, and it's not. The avian flu is 90% of this. Obviously, the inflation is still occurring in your products. You look over the last year, we've seen an increase in our ag products and 2% over this last year in pricing.
Yep.
Right now, we're seeing 20% plus in eggs. So it's just that they really have to dial in and figure out what we're going to do here. We're going to continue to see the effects probably throughout most of this year. Until we can really get it dialed in. And then we have to give those hens that survived time to repopulate and get our numbers back up in our flocks till we can see it kind of quiet down.
You know, that's a good lead in there to areas where people are laying eggs in, different scenarios. And that might be in the financial markets. We're going to pick that up with Mike Vondra here in just a little bit. Colton Young, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, you're looking a little thin, though, okay? If you need, you still have chickens around the household, don't you?
My mom does. I'm going to have to go raid her fridge here this weekend.
I'm happy for you. Okay. Mike Vondra joins us, certified financial planner, friend of the program here. It's an industry that his father, and wasn't it even your grandfather, Mike, involved
yes,
in?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, Grandpa Al.
Yeah. Father's father, and now yourself. And thanks for coming on and giving us some, I know yet you don't know everything to the nth degree about what's going on around here, but we appreciate the perspective, Mike. So I'm going to start with labor market is tight. There's some inflationary pressure, but the feds have done, in my mind, a surprisingly good job with the little tools that they have with it. Economic growth continues to be, I suppose it's okay. Let's start then, and we'll talk about trade policies because that obviously is one of those, things that they throw in that it's a wild card, I guess, is a good way to put it. What's your sense now of where we're at inflation-wise? How healthy is our economy? Do we believe the experts in it?
Yeah, so this is great questions, and there are so many tectonic plates that are shifting around, and in a perfect world, they kind of move together, but it seems like fairly regularly they butt up against each other, and we have little tremors or maybe even earthquakes that go through the economy. And certainly I see that with the capital markets, Tom. On the inflationary question, I'm looking at a chart right now showing kind of a 5-year, 6-year history of it. And you see the spike in 2022, and they say it got up about 9.1% at its highest mark. And they say now today we're sitting at 2.9%. Those numbers are really hard. At one point in my collegiate career, I learned how to do the inflationary calculation. And so when I was doing it back in 2022, when I was running the numbers, I could not get inflation by my math, like less than like 19%.
Right.
And then I would look at my wife's grocery bill and I'd go, yeah, I sure feels like it's a lot more than 9.1, like they're telling us. So I know there's some funny math that can be added to make it look a little lower, but and then the same would be true today, right? It doesn't feel like 2.9. I mean, it sure feels a whole lot higher than that. But yeah, inflation has come down. I think this last percentage point they're trying to get off of the inflationary curve is going to be the hardest. It's they'd really like inflation to be at about 2%. I think the Fed has been very clear about that, and it would appear that that's going to be the stickiest part of the inflation. And now we're to the point where inflation's on top of inflation, right? In order to actually erase, some of these price increases, we'd have to have deflation. We've not even come close to that. We've had what an economist would refer to as disinflation, which is just the slowing rise in the cost of something. But we all feel it, whether it's at the gas pump or insurance rates or at the grocery store. We all feel it, and it's taken its toll on the economy, Tom.
Yeah, it has. And when you talk about inflation, we get that number that comes basically it's based on our gross domestic product, but they remove certain products like energy. I know they've got a justification for it, but I don't know that justification adds up. That's why we like to talk about the real inflation, and that's what you were trying to pencil out there too. And I know that there's a couple of groups out there that focus on the real inflation. So we're feeling it. It might be measurable in one sense here, and we'll just that's a base that we'll go off of. With deinflation, that's not necessarily a good thing, right? Because then you've got an economy that's backtracking. Would that be true?
Yeah, it's a careful what you wish for thing.
Yeah.
With deflation. Deflation's, where I would say you got a supply and demand issue, right? If they put rates at, if the Fed was interested in deflation, they'd just throw rates to you know, whatever, 10, 20%, and it would just squash consumption. And then, yeah, demand would fall off a cliff, and producers would have to lower rates or lower prices so much that we'd be like, hey, this is great. We got deflation. That's phenomenal. Prices are down. But you know what the collateral effects of consumers being stopped in their tracks, you know, how many small business owners are out there? I mean, that would just cripple industry. And so the Fed has really had to walk a tightrope. And I got to give credit to them. I think they've done a good job. Once they finally woke up, they called it transitory for way too long. If they would have confronted this in 2021 when the numbers really started to rise, we would not have had all the issues from 22 and 23, 24. But better late than never. So they came in and they moved fairly assertively, and it's caused some issues within the economy, which has helped bring inflation down. But we're still feeling the effects of that inflationary wave that hit all of us consumers.
Yeah, what do you make of the tight labor market? You know, I look at this economy, and I have, I'm no expert, but I have, I don't think it's as rosy as folks like to kind of paint it. But then I see the tight labor market, and I go, well, that's probably a pretty good indication that we do have some good foundational principles.
Yeah, that would be something that, you know, that would kind of be the second half of the Fed mandate. The first half of the Federal Reserve's mandate is inflation. The second half is labor. And so they have remarkably been able to raise rates from all-time lows to recent highs without doing a ton of damage to the labor market. They have, you know, unemployment has risen just a tiny bit. And that, you know, in my opinion, that's you need to have employment. There needs to be equilibrium in the employment markets. A job has to be worth something. I think we watched in kind of the COVID days, there was so much money flying around that the workforce was so migrant at that point. It was so, people were just, a job wasn't worth anything. People were just jumping for a 5% raise here, a 10% raise over there. And if you don't have a value put on a job, then that's really not good for the labor markets. That has come back into balance, it seems like now. Good quality jobs are really valuable. So we do have a little bit more tension in the labor markets, but I'm not saying that as a negative thing. I think it's actually a good thing to have tension in the labor markets. And we have seen steady wage growth, which still sits at about 3.9%. So honestly, when you have wage growth at 3.9 and inflation at 2.9, that's actually pretty healthy. That means people's income is going up at a slightly faster pace than their groceries. That's something I think economists really like to see. But again, that really is, can you trust those numbers? Are people actually feeling that in their checkbook? That's a whole other conversation, Tom.
Yeah, and I know as we look at this, it really is a mixed bag. We maybe use that term pretty loosely at times, but if you're looking at the economic signals here, they're very mixed in my mind. We're walking a bit of a tightrope sometimes, we think, with our economy. We'll talk more about that. Tariffs as trade policy, tariffs as political strategy. And how do we respond at individual level? Mike Vondra is with us, certified financial planner. Also, we'll throw on artificial intelligence, AI. You know, that's the focus of this Economic Outlook seminar series from the BBER. We've been talking about it. I always mention it as a great, well, so informative to go to these events. There are 9 of them going on. We've already had some held. There's one going on in Billings this morning. Bozeman tomorrow, it's in the morning, so February 5th at the Commons. And then this week it's Butte the 6th, Northwestern Energy General Office in Butte. So the Economic Outlook Seminar Series, they are focusing on how businesses respond to AI, along with all the other great local and regional economic information that helps you make decisions. It's really one of those things that I think if you've got some things on your plate, get yourself informed about it. AI would be one of those. And we'll talk with Mike Vondra about that as well. Mike, again, thanks for being here. I appreciate that. I want to get right into trade and the market volatility, so to speak, because, of course, we've got a new administration. So in some areas, that's encouraging. And in other areas of our economy, they're going, well, that's not going to be good for our business model, so to speak. Tariffs as trade policy, tariffs as political strategy. The markets are going to respond I guess one way or the other, you know, as and I don't expect you to know what's in all these trade policies, but what's your sort of your take on this from that certified financial planner seat that you have?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's a hard question, and you're right. I don't know exactly what's in each of these tariff packages. I read about it over the weekend, and then it looks like everything was kind of paused yesterday. The markets were a little relieved with that. I will say that from a political standpoint, I don't know what kind of a political or tool or geopolitical tool tariffs are. Mm-hmm. So I'll just set that to the side. Maybe they're a phenomenal tool. I just don't know. That's not my arena. But from an economic standpoint and a capital market standpoint, they're widely agreed to be negative tariffs. So I'll just kind of come at it through that lens. They're viewed as hard on economics. They're viewed as hard on prices, which again hit producers and consumers, which of course changes consumption, production and consumption, then that would hurt GDP, that would hurt consumer spending, right? So the trickle down of tariffs, I don't think of tariffs as ever really meant to be a long-term solution. And if you look at the long-term trend line of tariffs, they've come down considerably over the decades, but what we're now facing would hike those considerably. So I don't think in my little world over here with the capital market, stock market, bond market, I don't think the stock market will respond well at all to substantial and long-term tariffs. If it's short-term, similar to like what we saw in 18, I think the market will digest it fairly quickly, come up with the ramifications and come up with a fairly healthy posture towards it. But if they're substantial and meant to be long-term, I think the market could be fairly harsh on those types of policies, and it could be prolonged harshness towards those things, Tom. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, there? Yeah, it does. I get that. And, I think there's valid reasons for them. And I'll probably explore a little more myself, too, with more of a dedicated trade expert as well about is America being taken advantage of in the trades, so to speak. We see what our trade deficit is, and then as this president would say, we've got all these things. We've got energy here, and we have a trade deficit in energy. We've got agriculture here, and that's not one of our trade deficits, but it is with Canada. And so I think that it is a part of both your economic and your political strategy, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Do the markets and the people that you work with, so to speak, do they what do they know about our trade imbalance? Is that a huge market or commercial concern?
Well, there's an interesting side of this, and I think you're totally right. It's worth digging into with somebody, a politician or a trade expert, because I'm just kind of coming at it from my perspective, and I acknowledge like there could be other non-financial reasons for tariffs, right? Mm-hmm. And so I acknowledge, right, like if we are being bullied on the world, my wife, in fact, last night, literally we're driving home from something, she asked me about it, and so I was kind of trying to unpack it with her. So it is a very dynamic conversation. There's several perspectives to look at with this conversation, but yes, it does appear we have been taken advantage of on the world stage as far as trade relations. And I don't know if it's because we're ignorant or we're just kind of this sleepy lumbering giant and we're just not hard on our trade partners like any good negotiation should be. I'm not sure exactly how to unpack all that, Tom, but it does appear that some autonomy here within the country could actually be positive for us from a long-term perspective. You know, there's a whole other humanitarian thing. It's like, why are you able to sell us these things for so much cheaper than we are? Are your labor standards different? Are your working conditions different? Are your income standards different, right? Like, I think you got to look at it also from a loving humanitarian standpoint. I'm thinking China, let's just say the name, right? Like, you think about some of these places, why are they able to sell us these things so much cheaper than we could sell them to ourselves? There's just, again, there's so many things to unpack there.
Yeah, and so we will do that at some other time here. I want to go into AI because, you know, as it's been around, but now more and more people are starting to dabble in it. And after dabbling, they start recognizing some uses, and then they start employing it as a resource. Where's it at with when we come to our person? This is what I appreciate about you. You know, you're a father, you're a husband, you've got three kids, and you're a certified financial planner. You know what we're going through. Your clients are going through. How do we embrace AI? You know, I guess any recommendations?
Yeah. So I'm just choosing to, I'm an optimist at heart, and sometimes even to a fault. So I'm choosing to embrace AI. I've got a conference I have to go to, and so I asked AI the other day. I said, "Hey, plan me a day in the Orlando area." And it came up with a huge list of things. And then I said, and it was a bunch of Disney stuff. And I said, not Disney stuff. and it planned me a whole nother thing. And I said, make it more affordable. And it modified it. And it was unbelievable. I'm like, I wonder what I would have paid a travel agent to plan this little extra day that I had. And I just thought, God, and so I asked AI, how much would I have paid a travel agent for a day? And I think this, Tom, is the power of microcosm of the power of generative intelligence. We've always had formulaic intelligence. That's, think, you know, a Google search result, however many pages of results. Generative intelligence is that it is constantly kind of growing and evolving. Now, is there going to be a dark side of this? Absolutely. There's going to be major issues with artificial generative intelligence. But there's also going to be a bright side and a very, very helpful side. And I took the news last week out of China with their DeepSeek technology that came out. I took that as a positive, right? I love the free markets. I love capitalism. I think competition is the best thing for us. So for the U.S. to go, holy buckets, China's making advancements too, and they're doing it faster and more affordable than us. Why don't we roll up our sleeves and get better? I mean, that was Trump's response as well, actually. He's like, hey, this is not a bad thing. We just got to compete better. And so I think that you know, it sent shockwaves through the capital markets for a couple of days. But yeah, I'm choosing to embrace artificial intelligence. But you do have to be worried about the dark side of really any evolution.
And I look at the markets too, and I think that they have also, I don't know if I would call it generative intelligence, but something similar to that. I don't see them maybe like, and I've only paid a little bit of attention years ago, but I don't see them overreacting to market news. Or maybe they do nowadays, but we see volatility. Maybe we're getting a little more used to it from that financial standpoint, and that's, in my mind, probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think, I mean, the last 2 years in the markets have been abnormally low volatility, which is weird because I do think we're at a very high level of uncertainty. The maximum declines in the stock market the last 2 years have been like 8 and 10% respectively. Average is negative 14. On average, the market sees a 14% pullback at least once a year. So two fairly calm years with unbelievably high amounts of uncertainty. So that's a weird dynamic there. But yeah, I do think the markets have become more comfortable with metabolizing uncertainty, if I could say it that way. Mm-hmm. That said, I don't expect this year to be very, very calm. I expect the markets to endure a good little bit of volatility this year, Tom.
Yeah, and I expect some things in that same nature, socially, economically. What's your encouragement, Mike? I got 1 minute here for you, and I know you've got another thing at 10 o'clock. And so, I appreciate just having a conversation about these things. You're dealing with people, and you're dealing with their finances, and you know, it's mm-hmm. psychologically engaging for you and for them as well. I know you're an optimist. I am as well. Wrap this up a little bit with what?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just go to really boring advice. Like I tell everybody, right? Like if I get a little 10-minute elevator speech, update your balance sheet. What do you own, and what do you owe? Right, update your balance sheet. Know where your chips are. Right, and then the other B, the two Bs, budget is the second B. First one's balance sheet, second one's budget. Just live within your means. I know that's really hard to do sometimes, but update your balance sheet, folks. Update your budget, live within your means. Things will go very well for you. So, Tom, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate having this time with you and your audience.
How many chicken wings are you eating on Sunday?
Yeah, that was maybe the most compelling thing. I'm a big consumer of chicken wings, so that was some really important news for me and my lifestyle. Big chicken wing going into Super Bowl weekend, right? Like, it's chicken wing palooza, right?
Yeah, it is. Yep. Well, enjoy, Mike. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the family. And thanks so much. And we'll chat again, okay? Because like you said,
yes, thanks, Tom. Anytime.
Yep, I anticipate a need for it. Mike Vondra again. Mike, thanks.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.